We're continuing to look at some of Jesus' parables this morning, and Matthew chapter 13 is the place where we've reached in verse 44. So we've already done the parable of the sower, the parable of the weeds and the wheat, the parable of the mustard seed and the parable of the yeast. And listen to some of Jesus' explanation of these pictures that he gave us, but all different pictures of what he calls the kingdom of heaven. The refrain comes through again and again as Jesus says, the kingdom of heaven is like this. And here's another thing, the kingdom of heaven is like this. And again and again, because what he really wants to do is to take things that people saw around them every day. And today we'll see somebody digging in a field and somebody else in the marketplace and somebody else pulling their fishing nets to the shore. And these would be everyday sights, a kind of what you and I see when we walk down Byers Road. And every time Jesus wants us to see the connection between what we see around us and heaven and the reign and the power and the authority of God, who is never absent from what we see. So in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 13, at verse 44, Jesus says this, the kingdom of heaven is like this. A man happens to find a treasure hidden in a field. He covers it up again and is so happy that he goes and sells everything he has and then goes back and buys that field. And also, the kingdom of heaven is like this. A man is looking for fine pearls. And when he finds one that is unusually fine, he goes and sells everything he has and buys that pearl. We'll come back and look at the rest of the chapter in just a little while. But Scotland's archaeological heritage is being plundered. I'm sure you're concerned to know, plundered by treasure hunters who fail to declare their finds in the national interest, authorities have warned through the Herald. Apparently, finders of treasure in England and Wales meekly troop along to the authorities and hand over their gold and silver, but Scots treasure hunters keep it for themselves. A new report by Crown officials raises concern over serious underreporting by the lucky few who stumble across buried artefacts. And I'm sure you're all outraged and appalled. But before you form your march of protest ahead for the city chambers, perhaps we should ask ourselves what we're meant to do with this teaching of Jesus, that such stealing of buried treasure is heavenly. Because that's surely what he's saying in verses 44 and 5. A man finds something that clearly doesn't belong to him, but he so engineers things that he gets to keep it anyway. And Jesus says, the kingdom of heaven is like this. Now, it's certainly true that the man in question goes and buys the field, so that does apparently make him legally entitled to the treasure he has found, but presumably he doesn't go up to the guy who is selling the field and say, you know that wee patch of ground over there that you don't think's worth very much? Well, I've just found gold and silver buried in it. Could I buy it, please, for a relatively cheap price? So the whole thing seems to be morally questionable, at least to our ears. But things were maybe different for the folks that Jesus was telling the story to. In those days, there were no banks. You might think that's a good thing, the way things have been going on recently. But it meant that if somebody had treasure, then probably the safest place to do was to bury it in a spot that you could find again. But what happened was that the people who buried it sometimes died. Maybe it would be a soldier about to go off to battle, or someone heading off on a dangerous journey, and they never came back again. And because they'd buried it to keep it safe in a location no one was likely to find and hadn't told anyone else where that was, the treasure was lost until someone like this man happens to find it. And then, of course, there was no way of tracing who it belonged to. And so the law in those days came up with a simple solution to deal with this problem of unallocated treasure trove. And the law was essentially finders keepers. So what happened here and what the man did was perfectly in keeping with common practice. And in fact, what that law does is raise the question, why did he bother going off to buy the field? Because the law was not that the person in whose ground the treasure was buried owned it, but it belonged to the person who found it. So why did he have to go and buy the field? And the answer to that probably is that the one exception to the law that said finders keepers was that if the person who found the treasure was working for somebody else at the time, then the treasure belonged to the person for whom he was working. So just as if you were a farm worker and you planted corn, which grew up to provide a harvest belonged to the farmer for whom you had been working. So if you dug up treasure, the treasure belonged to your employer. And once we understand that, it helps us to build up the picture and make the assumptions that Jesus' audience would have made, that this man who found the treasure was nothing more than a humble farm laborer, someone who worked long hours for a small day's pay and for someone else's benefit. Someone for whom the sum total of everything that he owned when he sold it in the story was only just enough to buy a small patch of land. And someone who stumbled across wealth that he hadn't been looking for, when probably all that was on his mind was the question of how he was going to feed his wife and child that night. And yet, in spite of being so poor, with no prospects, he ends up able to possess the treasure. The kingdom of heaven, says Jesus, is like this. Notice that the kingdom of heaven is like buried treasure. That's not the picture Jesus is drawing. He says the kingdom of heaven is like this. A man discovers buried treasure and it changes his life. So the kingdom of heaven is a place of transformation. And we understand the kingdom when we understand the difference that God can make to a man such as this. So perhaps today Jesus would say the kingdom of heaven is like winning the national lottery without even having bought the ticket, which is the only way any Christian ever should win the lottery, in case you're wondering. So I guess the point is this, that none of us should ever write ourselves off. None of us should ever say, well, I'm not a religious person, or I'm not interested. You're not likely to find me in church at any point in time. And none of us should make the same mistake with our friends, because God is able to take us by surprise. When we're not looking for him, we're still able to dig him up. So it's not just spiritual inquirers at church membership classes, or people who accept an invitation to evangelistic events, or spend their time in libraries or bookshops reading up on spirituality, but people who currently deny even the existence of God and mock those weak enough to get sucked into using the crutch of religion, or even angrily campaign against the power and influence the church still has. It's people who are struggling to make ends meet, who are out in the streets or living on benefits, who are not sure where their next meal is coming from and don't have the time to play around with the luxury of spirituality. It's maybe people who are here in church this morning, bored with what we're doing and saying and simply going through the motions. Or people who are planning to get round to sorting themselves out with God at some point in the future when time permits. All of these folk in heaven's kingdom can be hijacked by God, who is never on their agenda, but nevertheless it gets on their way. In just the same way here, that a man happens to find a treasure hidden in the field where he is working. And when that happens, when we stumble across the God whom Jesus is describing to us here, when that happens, and I think this is Jesus' point, when that happens, that God can grab our attention and so upset our priorities that nothing else matters anymore, and suddenly God becomes the most important thing to us in all the world. The kingdom of heaven, says Jesus, is like this. And really, it asks every one of us this question as to whether we treasure God. Not whether we know about God or have heard this story before. Not whether we allow God access to some of our time on Sunday mornings or during the week. Not whether we occasionally give him a tenth of our income, perhaps. But do you treasure God like this man? Have you met God in such a way that he has spurred you into action with this kind of drop everything, change everything, reorganize your whole life around the one whom you've met? Has he grabbed you and thrilled you and filled you with good things that last forever? Because think of what I think we're meant to see in this story is not that this man found the treasure and blew it in one ecstatic day of debauchery. Turned up in the marketplace the following morning looking for someone else to employ him as a laborer again. I think we're meant to see that it changed his life forever. Has meeting God done that for you? Has Christianity been a one-off thrill that happened to you at some time in the past, and ever since then you've been trying to recapture it? Or is the kind of impact of meeting God that I'm describing to you something that you've heard in other people's experience and you've always been looking for? Or have you really stumbled across God, the God whom Jesus describes? Or maybe there are folks here who, while they're not in total poverty, because they've inherited enough spiritual capital or religious tradition or Christian experience to satisfy themselves, they know where their next spiritual hunger pangs are going to be satisfied, and they're able to do that without ever letting themselves go. And all the time they're living close to where the treasure is buried, but have never uncovered it. Or maybe they have uncovered it and then they've covered it over again and said to themselves, I can go back and get it later when I need it. Well, I think if Jesus was here, he would say the kingdom of heaven is not like that. But the kingdom of heaven is also like this in verse 45, that a man is looking for fine pearls. So the story here is different. This is someone who has a sense of expectation. This is the interested inquirer. This is a man of means, because you don't find beggars in jewelry shops looking to buy. So this represents the spiritual inquirer who knows the value of faith and prayer, who has previously received and understood some religious teaching. Probably the man in the parable is a trader in pearls. So it represents somebody who shares what he has received and understood about God with other people and listens to them and learns from them. And all the time as he goes around from church to church or faith to faith, he's trying to build up his fortune. And yet even that man who already has so much, says Jesus, in the kingdom of heaven is completely transformed. Because the kingdom of heaven is once again not like a precious pearl, but like the difference that finding that pearl makes to the man. Because you see what he does, he doesn't just add it to the rest of his collection, but replaces all of the rest with this, selling what he owns in order to be able to buy. Can you picture him, that man, setting out that morning before the parable began? Probably a wealthy man, well fed that morning, well dressed in his fine jacket, quite possibly waited on by a servant or two to open the shop doors as he goes in and out to drive his fast car. He's got money in his pocket and he's got other pearls in his back that he might choose to buy and sell. And then we see the same man at the end of the day and he's homeless because he sold his home. And hungry because he hasn't eaten since breakfast time. And naked because he's sold the shirt off his back. And all alone because he's had to pay off his servants. With nothing left in his hand except for this one fine pearl. And for the whole of the rest of his life he will never buy anything again because he's got no money left. And nothing he's willing to sell. And yet he won't miss his fine feather bed that evening or his cup of wine or the shirt off his back. If anything else, so it's not an attractive picture, is it? If anything else so captivated somebody, whether it was their work and the amount of time and energy as they threw themselves into climbing the career ladder or drugs or sport or sex, or anything else, if anyone was so captivated, we would call it addiction. And we would pity them and their loved ones, and we would try to wean them off it and help them recover and live a more balanced life. Everything in moderation rather than one thing taken to excess. But what Jesus is here is saying is that God is the one thing that we are never in any danger of taking to success, that we can never have too much of, the one that we should be addicted to whom the rest of our lives should be gladly surrendered in devoted service. So what we have here is two very, very similar parables, in a sense. And yet what they bring together is two opposite extremes, the rich man and the poor man. The one with so much to lose and the one with little to offer. The one who is actively seeking and the other who stumbled across by accident. And yet, in the end, the two end up in exactly the same place and you couldn't tell them apart. Because the kingdom of heaven is total transformation from whoever we are with whatever we have to having nothing and lacking nothing, possessing and possessed by God. The kingdom of heaven, says Jesus, is like this. One of the problems with reading the parable of the buried treasure and the pearl is that we turn it into a lesson that says you've got to be ready to sacrifice everything for Jesus. We focus on those words that says the laborer or the pearl trader sold all they have. And we feel guilty because we haven't done that. We all know there's things in our lives that we haven't given to God and wouldn't be prepared to, and there's no point in being dishonest about that. If we were asked to spend such and such a sum of money to give it to a cause or to go to an event when we had something else on or whatever it was, we all know that there are things we're not prepared to do. And then we look up to and we admire those Christians who have really made huge sacrifices, top of the list are overseas missionaries, I suppose. And we say, those are the special ones, because they've given up so much. And so we feel guilty, and then we accept that we're not among those heroes, and we satisfy ourselves with the little that we have. But if you take the whole picture, there wouldn't have been a single person in Jesus' audience who would have said, what an amazing sacrifice the farmer made. Or what an amazing sacrifice the pearl trader made. They'd have said how lucky they were. I wish I could find some buried treasure. They didn't make sacrifices, they bought a bargain. And so if you're one of those folks, and I guess this is probably all of us, if you're one of those folks who knows that there are things you're not yet prepared to do for God, then your prayer should not be, Lord, make me more committed, make me more holy, make me more sacrificial. Your prayer should be, Lord, show me the bargain. Show me yourself. So that giving away all that I have and all that I am is something I can do without a second thought. Because I know I'm on to a winner. In verse 47, Jesus says, also the kingdom of heaven is like this. Some fishermen throw their net out in the lake and catch all kinds of fish. And when the net is full, they pull it to shore and sit down to divide the fish. The good ones go into their buckets, and the worthless ones are thrown away. Well, it will be like this at the end of the age. The angels will go out and gather up the evil people from among the good and will throw them into the fiery furnace where they will cry and grind their teeth. The words in verses 49 and 50 are exactly the same as in verses 41 and 2 that we read last Sunday. In primary one, my daughter came home from school and told us that her teacher had called her an elephant. Now, I didn't think that was very nice, and neither did she to begin with. I know, as I'm sure you do, that my daughter is the most beautiful, graceful and elegant young lady, with the possible exception of her mother, that God has ever created. She certainly is not round and fat. She doesn't have big ears or an unusually large nose. Her primary one teacher said she was an elephant. But what surprised me even more that the teacher had said what seemed to me a very offensive thing was that Katrina came home full of pride and said, Mrs. Kyle says I am an elephant. And the reason was, you see, that elephants never forget. And what our teacher was doing was complimenting her memory, which we have often found out to our cost since is truly remarkable. You said, she said, that I could have when I was 10 years old. Her memory, sometimes selectively, is remarkably good. And that, of course, is how illustrations work, isn't it? When you say a ballet dancer is as graceful as a swan, you doesn't mean she's got a big beak and webbed feet. When you say that your love is like a red, red rose, you don't mean that she's prickly and covered in compost. So when Jesus says the kingdom of heaven is like this and tells us a story, what he means is that there is something in the picture that he has drawn which we should recognize as resembling the kingdom of heaven. And when he does what he does in Matthew chapter 13 and tell us a whole succession of pictures, lead us through a picture gallery, then what we need to do is learn from them all and put all that we've learned together to get the whole story. So if all we had was the picture of the parable of the net, where the worthless fish are separated from the good ones and thrown mercilessly away, then we might object to that, just as we might have objected to the earlier parable of the of the wheat and the weeds, when the weeds were gathered in and burnt and only the good harvest was kept, because it seems like very hard luck on those people who turn out to be represented in the parable by the wrong kind of fish or the wrong kind of plant. Because we know that you cannot turn one species of fish into another. And you go to the fish shop and ask for a herring and all they have is cod. You can't say, that's fine, I'll take the cod and turn it into a herring on the way home. You can't turn a weed into wheat. So it seems to say that the evil people never stood a chance and Jesus doesn't care. But that, of course, cannot be true, because the other two parables that we've only just read have been all about transformation, about the difference that it makes to someone when they come across God. And the parable of the sower is also about the way that people respond to God. And all the time Jesus is saying, as often as he says, the kingdom of heaven is like this, he says, if you have ears, then listen, because what we think about what Jesus says is what makes all the difference. So what is the parable of the net about if the message is not that our fate is sealed and God has made up his mind? Well, part of what it's about is this. You know how sometimes people say that we should love the sinner and hate the sin? And I think that's good advice. I think it faithfully describes what Jesus did when he came to earth. The Bible tells us in John chapter 3 that God so loved the world, he sent his only Son. And in John's Gospel, the world is always not the physical globe, but the place of evil and darkness where wrong things are done. God so loved the world that he sent his only Son. And then Paul reminds us in Romans chapter 5 that it was when we were still sinners that Christ died for us. Love the sinner and hate the sin. But what I think Jesus is saying here is that there will come a time. See, when the parable of the net is set in verse 49, it will be like this at the end of the age. There will come a time when you can no longer separate the sinner from the sin. And he clearly didn't think that had happened yet, because Jesus' opening speech in Matthew 4:17 was telling people to turn away from their sins because the kingdom of heaven is near. So this parable of the net is being told now about what will happen at the end of the age, not because people cannot be changed now, but actually the very opposite, because they still can. And it's really, really important that they are, as long as there's still time. Because Jesus says in verse 49, the angels will go out and gather up the evil people from among the good. And we recognize that Jesus wouldn't last long in our society today. He's far too judgmental. Who does he think he is to start saying whether the thing that someone else does is right or wrong for them? But actually, who Jesus thinks he is and who he really is the fundamental question, because if he is whom he claims to be, then he has every right. And whether we agree with that or not, at the end of the age, none of us will be able to stop him. But for now, the one whom God sent into the world because he loves the world and who died for sinners, when that is still what they were, for now, that one who says, repent or turn away from your sins because the kingdom of God is near, well, his patience and his kindness and his tolerance are legendary. And we see him in Matthew's Gospel and the others eating and drinking with sinners, in inverted commas, and tax collectors, and letting the prostitute come and wash his feet and speaking to those whom good people didn't have time for. So his patience and his kindness and his tolerance are legendary. But listen also to what Paul says in Romans chapter 2, verse 4. Perhaps you despise his great kindness, tolerance, and patience. That is to say, you take it for granted. He's patient with me because I'm worth waiting for. He tolerates me because I'm not that bad. And Paul goes on, surely you know that God is kind because he is trying to lead you to repent. So if you did want to mix all the parables up and extend the parable of the net to include all the others, then what it would show you is Jesus in the water beside all the other fish, trying miraculously to turn them into something that would be acceptable before the net is cast. But the time will come in verse 49 when angels will go out and gather up the evil people from among the good. What is good? He will gather up the evil people from among the good. Well, what we know is that they cannot be those who have inherited goodness simply by being well brought up. Because in the previous parables of the buried treasure and the pearl, neither of the men inherited their wealth. And we also know that they cannot be people who have earned their goodness by hard moral effort, the way that children try to be good so that Santa Claus will come. Because again, neither the farm laborer nor the trader in perils really earned the treasure that they end up possessing. And we also know that they cannot just be naturally good people, happily born with a nice disposition towards loving others, because in our previous parables, neither man started off owning the treasure. To be sure, in the previous parables, both of them purchased their wealth, giving up everything they had to buy it. But both at such a price that they knew that what they had was the bargain that we spoke about. Yes, they gave up everything, but they got much more back in return. And if you'd ask them, they wouldn't talk about their hard-earned wealth. They'd talk about their fortune or their gift. And what they actually bought in real life was not goodness, but God. And it was God who made them good. It was God who made their fortunes. That's what the kingdom of heaven is like. We find God and give him the little that we have. And in return, he gives us everything. He gives us himself as he is crucified on the cross. He gives us himself as the Holy Spirit is poured out into our hearts and becomes a part of our lives. And he prepares his home in heaven to welcome us as rightful owners. So those who receive him will be gathered up for good at the end of the age by the angels. Do you understand these things? Jesus asked them. In verse 51, yes, they answered. So he replied, this means then that every teacher of the law who becomes a disciple in the kingdom of heaven is like the owner of a house who takes new and old things out of his storeroom. And that really explains the point of the parable of the net. Not that it's there to scare unbelievers into faith. Are you not so scared of the bad fire that you'll decide to become a Christian? Because people are not scared by things they don't believe in. Nor is the purpose to make those who are believers smug and complacent, because that doesn't make us more like Jesus. The purpose of the parable of the net is to say this, that what we have believed, the new things that Jesus is teaching us here, which agree with all that God has revealed before in the whole of the Old Testament, are not for keeping to ourselves, but for bringing out of our treasure store and putting on display. So if anyone ever says to you, or you have ever said, my Christian faith is a private thing, I keep it to myself, tell them, no, it's not. The kingdom of heaven is not like that. Faith is not a private thing, but a public responsibility. Not my drawing attention to myself, look at my beautiful pearl, but my pointing to him. And the kingdom of heaven is like this, when we see ourselves as owners who share what we didn't pay for, and as disciples who pass on to others more than we understand, and as teachers of a law that we know that we cannot keep, and as gifted ones who give away what we actually cannot lose. The kingdom of heaven, says Jesus, is like this.